Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour and an hour of Cambridge food and drink. Thanks, of course, to Ian Dayborn for seeing us through the last couple of hours of April Fool's Day. And we can all relax now. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. And today's programme is a real celebration of excellence. We talk with Hans Schweitzer, master chef at Cotto, Cambridge's best restaurant according to TripAdvisor. We visit Alison McTaggart, bread on a bike, who bakes from her home oven and supplies Cotto with some of its bread. Also operating from home is Stella Pereira. Those of us who managed to get a table at her supper club last Saturday had a night to remember. She describes the food.
I visited Hot Numbers this week for a fascinating tasting of their current range of coffees and to hear more about them. And we've all heard of five a day, five portions of fruit and vegetables a day. But what about 10 a day? And what do Cambridge people think? Well, we asked them. We've also got some Cambridge food and drink news at the end of the programme, including some rather nice jobs. So let's begin.
Well, like many people, I was alarmed when it was announced that Cotto in East Road was to close. There were rumours that chef Hans Schweitzer was moving back to Barbados, where he had worked some years ago, and that would have been a big loss to Cambridge. He won a Michelin star at the age of 29. And then we learned that Cotto was moving to the Gonville Hotel in Gonville Place, where Hans was to be master chef. And that's where I spoke with him on Thursday, about what's on the menu, as well as some of his own history. Hans, you've worked in a lot of countries, including Iran.
Yes, I was probably the last 2 years of the Shah's reign. I was in Iran, and it was such an incredible experience because they're such lovely people, and it's a shame it's been slightly wrongly represented in the political world these days, in our religious world. But culinary-wise, it was incredible because, you know, everyone thinks the Chinese think they do the best rice, the Japanese, the Indians, but the best rice comes from Iran, there's no question. They have such a microclimate up by the Caspian Sea. The corns are nearly an inch long and the flavors are absolutely incredible. They have their bread, they do a flat bread, and they bake it in like a dome of burning pebble stones and with a beautiful crust. And there's so many lovely elements. Or, you know, the seafood from the Gulf, they got this huge prawns and Caspian Sea with the caviar. And it was an exciting experience to work there with a huge culinary history, which goes back to the emperors of India, the influence from the Persian war in India, and some of the spices they brought with them. So it was a completely different experience.
But for you, being a chef with your roots in the West, were you cooking sort of Western food, or were you adopting the...
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of like an administrative executive job. I had 80 chefs, you know, so I was delegating the whole thing. And it was quite funny in those days. We're talking 30 years ago, and you had to sort of wear a white jacket with gold buttons. And I said, why do you have to wear this? And I said, because people respect you more. So it was like wearing a uniform in the circus. But professionally, it was incredible. We had like 10 butchers, and it was a huge experience for me.
Yes, yeah. And also you worked in Istanbul.
Istanbul, we opened a hotel. I was only there for a couple of weeks, but it was different again. It was more westernized, and but also, you know, Turkey has got some beautiful produce, and you know, it's just onions, basic things like aubergine, and they all taste fresh in the summer. They just taste different. Tomatoes, you know, and the herbs and parsley and all of that.
And the fish as well.
Oh, fish, yeah. And the lemons and citrus fruit. It's incredible. Yeah.
So some great experiences. Yeah. So you draw on them all here in Cotto.
I try and put it back together, yeah.
That's fantastic. Cotto's now moved and is part of the Gonville Hotel. I'm wondering why the move took place and how it's gone.
We have moved because we felt we have outgrown the old Cotto. I feel It was very, very hard on our service staff to go up the stairs and down 50, 60, 17 times a night. And it sort of became apparent that we must do a change. And when the opportunity came up to join a Gonville Hotel as a partner with Cotto Restaurant, we took the opportunity and we created, as you can see, the brand new, beautiful dining room, which is very full of lights. You can see Parker's Piece, and we are creating a lovely terrace to go with it. So that was an obvious choice for us to come here.
Yes, well, this is very nice. And has it worked well?
Oh, we are very, very busy, yeah, and we're very happy with the way it goes so far.
And your menu is similar to the style of menu you had originally, presumably?
That's, you know, going back a little bit, because you always get asked as a chef, so what do you do? Do you do Italian? Do you French? What is it? And, you know, having a history as a chef, being cooking over a dozen of different countries, I have to sort of go back to my roots and sort of probably get the best bits from everywhere. It was a bit of like cosmopolitan cuisine, but the roots are actually British produce and products, and which we find here in this fantastic country with, you know, the sea around. You get beautiful seafood, fish, best lamb in the world from here, and don't forget, cheese has become incredibly good in this country, and some of the cheeses are better than in France. So it's really a pleasure to work here as a chef.
So tell us about some of the things that are on the menu now which you're particularly pleased with.
I mean, one of my best sellers is still our sort of seafood soup, and it's a little bit like a French bisque, but the history of that is when I went to Grenada, and I worked in the Caribbean for 12 years, and I went to a friend's home, and his mother was sort of doing a soup for us, and it was so full of flavor. I said, how do you make that soup so wonderful? And he said, you have to use the head of the shrimps and the lobsters to get the flavors. So then I copied that and added my own ingredients and came up with this beautiful soup, and my customer seems to love it, and got different types of seafood in it, some little baby organic vegetables, and it's absolutely delicious. So that's, I recommend it to everyone.
any meat dishes you particularly?
Obviously now in spring is lamb, and I'm very proud of our lamb, because there was a time when we went into sous vide cooking, which basically you trim off the meat and then you cook it in the water bath to break down, you know, the fats and everything. And but I went back to the original flavors, because if you cook meat, you want the roasting flavors, you want the juices, and you only get them if you keep the fat on and the bones. So we went back to our rack of lamb, roasted on the bone, sear and brown the fat, the outside of the rack, to get all the flavors, and then we brush it with mustard and make a beautiful herb crust. It's nearly a classic dish, but you can't really improve it. So I always recommend our lamb with a beautiful natural juice.
Any particular desserts you recommend?
Dessert, you know, I'm known as a chocolatier. As you know, I worked in Paris and Switzerland to train as a chocolatier, but I've been looking back to my culinary history, and I came up with the idea of the memories of the Caribbean, and I have created a West Indian dessert which sort of includes caramelized bananas, char grilled pineapples soaked in a nice spicy West Indian syrup, and we serve that with a coconut passion fruit ice cream and little sort of crumbles, and which replicates the sea, and it's a beautiful combination of flavors and textures, and I thought that's quite exciting. It's not something which grows in this country, but, you know, bananas is so common these days, it's quite nice to do something with it.
Does the menu change regularly?
We change, not the menu, but we change items on it,
yeah,
because some of our regulars would be too shocked if everything would be new one day, and so they'll like some of our sort of, let's say, standard dishes, and we're not going to touch them too much, but there are constant moves on our menus, you know, new desserts here, new starter, different main course, fish is always different, so there are slight changes all the time.
Yeah, so does that mean you're spending part of your week developing new dishes then?
We just developed a new dessert last night. We came up with something for the summer with the Cambridge strawberries and berries, but we are already planning for that with a very, very thin, fine meringue, and we call it probably something like Cambridge mess with berries and chantilly cream, and make it a sort of enlightened kind of Eden mess, really, but it comes along really beautifully.
Now, talking about your chocolatier expertise, I mean, yeah, you have been named as one of the 10 world's best chocolatiers, and I remember reading a story about you making some miniature chocolate pianos for Pavarotti?
Yeah, that's the story. You know, when I worked at Sandy Lane, Pavarotti used to stay with us every
year. That's in Barbados.
That's in Barbados, yeah. The best hotel in the Caribbean. And Pavarotti came with his entourage, and they used to stay 3 weeks every year in March before their American tour. One night, he gave a concert for the island, basically, and it was absolutely fantastic. But after that, he wanted to have a party on the beach, so he invited 250 guests, and he said, I want something in a musical theme, and something many people never knew, that Pavarotti actually played the piano, and we had a beautiful baby Grant, and he said, what can you do? I said, okay, let's work on that. So I created the baby Grant piano out of chocolate, and it used to be, and it still is a big hit. It's not on the menu at the moment because I made so many of them, thousands of pianos, so I gave it a break, but people still come and ask for it.
So the 200 chocolate pianos weren't all for Pavarotti himself, then?
No. It was a set menu, and everyone had the piano. And ever since, it's been on the menu, really, because it's been so successful.
And there's also an extraordinary story about you cooking some Dover sole for Muhammad Ali.
When we took over at the Skyline Hotel in London, our company, and I was sort of introducing our kitchen policies, I had this phone call one morning and said, Muhammad Ali is up in the suite and he needs 3 or 4 Dover soles, but he doesn't want to come down because he just lost his fight last night. He just flew over from Las Vegas. So I said, okay, turn on the flambe trolley and put on a big pan, and I took 3 Dover soles up to his suite. And, you know, there was a bodyguard and some, you know, PR people, and they said, oh, he's in his bedroom. Just go in there. So I went in, and suddenly this lady jumped out of the bed with his red negligee on. And anyway, Mohammed, he came out of the shower and said, come in, don't worry about that. And so I cooked the Dover sole for him. And I never knew which sort of impact that would have on my life eventually, you know, because it was such an incredible moment.
Yeah, right.
One quite interesting story about when Her Majesty the Queen, she was coming to Barbados, and the Prime Minister called me. I was already here in Cambridge, and asked me if I could do the function for 2,000 people on Alora Court, which is the government building. So, okay, I come over. So everything, sort of, we arranged the whole party, and we had all the different foods and canapes and drinks and anything you wanted. And it was sort of late afternoon, evening, 6 o'clock. And we asked the Queen what she would like to have to drink, and she said, I have a cup of tea. I thought, oh, my God. One thing we don't have is tea. So the butler, he ran down to the kitchen and started putting on the kettle to make the tea. And he came up with this beautiful silver tray with all this, you know, teas and everything. And all he saw, the Queen, gone back into her Rolls Royce and drove off. And that was a very sad moment, because everything we'd done was for the Queen, but the only thing she wanted was tea, and she couldn't get it.
On the subject of sourcing, how much work does that take? It strikes me that you've been pretty thorough, because some of your bread is cooked in Cambridge, isn't it, by Alison MacTaggart?
Alison, I don't want to tell everyone because I want to have your bread, but no, Alison is probably the best artisan baker I have met in a long time. And I'm a big fan of San Francisco sourdough, and I used to do that when I worked in San Francisco. But she is top, and she does a couple of very special breads for us. We bake a lot of bread ourselves, but she does the cumin and potato bread, which is out of this world, and her walnut and raisin bread is also incredible. So we have a standard relationship there. But also, you know, a lot of products we try and get. Uppington is an organic farm, you know, get some nice little fresh vegetables now, especially in the early summer. Again, looking forward to that. And we always try and source some different products. But sometimes it's not always possible, but we do try to be organic if we can. And it's getting better and better. There are more and more small farmers who actually produce that sort of kind of food, which is good news.
Yes. So you're getting a lot of local food. You mentioned before Michelin stars, and I know you've had Michelin stars in your time. Time Cotto got one, I think.
Actually, there was a bit of an uproar recently because the Cambridge Evening News sort of named me sort of like the Michelin star chef has moved to Gonville Hotel, and had the Michelin inspector here recently, and I told him that wasn't my intention. I don't want to decorate myself with something I don't have. But the fact is, I used to have a Michelin star, and I'm very proud I used to have one. And maybe we get one again one day. You don't know.
Well, I think you should.
Thank you.
And that was Hans Schweitzer of Cotto, now at the Gonville Hotel, a wonderful restaurant. And as Hans said, they'll be opening the terrace up soon, so you'll be able to sit out in the open enjoying the most wonderful food while looking out on Parker's Peace.
Yeah, and we'll be hearing from Alison McTaggart of Bread Fame a little later in the programme. Now, you've heard the phrase stuffing a quart into a pint pot. Well, here's an hour and a half of coffee tasting at Hot Numbers on Gwydir Street, squeezed into 6 minutes.
The really important thing with coffee tasting is to really give it a... If you don't do that, you can't taste anything, especially the acidity, which is how we buy the coffee. So it's really, really important to give it a slurp.
Do the slurping noises make it rage?
Anyone not got a spoon? Yeah. What you get when you buy specialty grade coffee, why is it specialty? Why is it important? So coffee is actually a really, really hard thing to grow. It takes 3 years to start producing fruit. It's incredibly low yielding. So one tree will only produce about 300 grams, so basically a bag of coffee. And that only starts producing fruit after 3 years. Once you've got that, there's obviously all these rounds of sorting going on. So you're not necessarily getting your 300 grams for your tree just because you will get defects. In terms of sort of the speciality grade market, you're looking at, if you imagine it, a pyramid, the capstone of the pyramid. Speciality coffee is that real top of the pyramid, if you will. So really, like, I think it was only sort of maybe 1 or 2% of the world's coffee is speciality grade. As more and more people are doing things like this and getting into speciality, the higher the demand.
When I became an adult, I remember coming to a coffee shop, tasting an espresso, and it was just like, this taste of fruit and floral and flowery, and how is this tiny little thing just got this crazy taste? And I realised that I was really into it and I wanted to be part of the specialty coffee, or the third wave as it is at the moment. Became a barista and now I'm moving into Cambridge to work at a proper specialty coffee shop.
You mentioned the third wave of coffee.
As coffee was introduced and changed through the years, so you had the first coffee was this big, dark, Italian, super heavy, super strong, and then it started to get more refined and more specialty. And where we are now is a lot of like the delicate, light coffees that we're drinking that Hot Numbers specialises in.
We generally have everything on our shelf within about 2 to 3 days of roasting. So it's all super fresh.
It's all about making sure that everything's weighed and everything's temperature checked, and it's all detailed to the finest point, really.
Hope everyone knows the coffee's cherry. Inside the cherry, you've got two seeds. What makes a difference in flavour is obviously where the coffee's grown, and that's why we're here today. Flavour comes from the processing. The number one process is called a natural process coffee, and you've got your coffee cherry with your two seeds in the middle. And all they do is they just let the coffee cherry dry around the two seeds. Now what that does, like when you ferment wine, whiskey, beer, it adds a fermenty sort of flavour. So what you get really, really fruity coffee. I don't know if anyone's ever had super fruity coffee, but a natural processed coffee will be really, really fruity. It'll have fermenty notes. So one of the coffee on the table that we've got is from Ethiopia. They traditionally did natural processed coffees just because they don't have enough water to wash the seed, and that's how they do it. So what that means is we've got such a high quality coffee, they score coffee like wine. So the coffee on the table is actually a 91 point scoring coffee. So it's really, really good time of year to do this because it's such a special coffee that we've got.
And so, at the Hot Numbers coffee tasting, we tried a selection of African specialty blends. From Burundi, which had a tropical, fruity, sweet tobacco aroma, to the Blue Mountain varietal from the Congo, which had this blood orange, sweet brown sugar taste, to the Kenyan, with an intensely sweet blackcurrant flavour.
Imagine that cherry drying around that seed in the sun, as that adds all those fermenty flavours to the coffee. If they're done really badly, you get sort of vinegary fermentation sort of taste. If they're done really well, you get it like this, where it's like super fruity, really complex, violet, blueberry. There's so many reasons to buy specialty coffee. It's such a better product. There's way more work that goes into it. Coffee from Africa is really, really different from coffee from South America, but it really makes a massive difference, not only where it's grown like wine, but the variety that's used. So coffee's easily just thought of like an apple. Some countries grow a variety because it works the best in their soil, like with winemakers. Some will just do it for flavour.
You know where Eddie is right now?
You might try the Club Flamingo. He hangs out there with some chorus girl, a floozy named Mimi Dujour.
Dujour? She French?
That's just her stage name. Her real name is Mimi Coffee.
Coffee?
No, thank you.
We're looking for things from sort of African coffees like berry notes, from sort of South American coffees. We're looking at sort of chocolatey, more nutty, more savoury kind of notes, more kind of traditional coffee. If you ever sort of had Italian style coffee, a lot of it will be South American coffee. As the life cycle of the coffee continues, after 2 weeks, sometimes it can taste better. It's constantly changing product, and when people sort of realise that, it starts to become really exciting because they're, you know, for example, that Kenyan there, that's probably about a month old, that
that's
Kenyan.
That's actually really old. That
yeah,
Kenyan.
Really, really old.
But it tastes amazing.
Yeah, it keeps on getting better.
It's kind of starting to come into Ethiopian season now. The coffees are starting to get shipped over, so hopefully this crop this year might be maybe better, might be just different. But that's the beauty of it as well, that each crop, whether we get it by year after year, it's gonna be different, hopefully in an interesting way. Hopefully, yeah.
You're gonna look at things like floral, jasmine. Anyone who doesn't drink coffee and just drinks tea will love an Ethiopian washed coffee because they're jasmine, they sort of can be bergamot, like Earl Grey. But then you go to another region and it can be tropical fruit, berry, all these kind of really interesting flavours. It's such a great region, Ethiopia, because it's so diverse.
So, yeah, it was basically a developing understanding of the unknown and wanting to get a little bit of clarification, a little bit of information. And it's done that perfectly. It's really nice.
Yeah, there's no going back now.
That's what it is. Coffee's a lot of fun. I mean, like, there's 25 people here today. Having a chat with all of them, I haven't met any of them before. Some of them know absolutely nothing about coffee. Some of them know more than I do. So it's a really, really interesting night, actually. Definitely will come back for the next one.
And that was just the merest flavour of the coffee tasting evening that was devoted to African coffees. The varieties Hot Numbers had on offer, they are new to the scene, and African coffee tastes significantly different to South American coffee. Like wine, as they said, the location and the variety of the coffee that's picked will make a difference. And just like an apple, different varieties taste different.
And sadly, there just isn't enough time in today's programme to go into the other topics from that evening, like how to score coffee, the effects of climate change on the coffee fruit, of making your coffee with different types of water, and the roasting process was only briefly alluded to.
But we hope some of the descriptions caught help to detail the chasm between, say, your dried coffee granules and the rich, fruity, chocolatey, vanilla, floral, all those delicate flavours that you can get with these coffees. Now, if you have any serious coffee questions, you can always email roastery@hotnumberscoffee.co.uk or pop into one of their cafes. Again, this time of year, really exciting because all the African coffee is now in. And that music signals time again for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, Arjuna in Mill Road has tweeted they've got some fresh, soft, sticky, vegan hot cross buns in store today. Urban Larder, also in Mill Road, has Amandine and Tarte au Citron from the excellent Gourmandise. I recommend those highly. And the Mitre pub in Bridge Street has a sampling event on Thursday with Sharp's Brewery.
Lovely.
Now, there's been some research carried out by Imperial College with Leeds University and others, and it's suggested that there are strong health benefits to eating 10 portions of fruit and vegetables a day. It's said by the NHS to be a strong piece of research with good statistical methodology. The people of Cambridge I spoke to, by Chris's fruit and veg stall at the market, had rather mixed views, though.
Excuse me, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio. We're asking people if they've heard of the idea of eating 10 portions of fruit and vegetables a day.
Yes, I did hear about it. I thought I'll stick to trying to make 5 portions. 10 is a bit ridiculous. I mean, you'd have to eat nothing else.
But you manage 5?
Sometimes. Sometimes.
I don't count everything in that way, but I eat a lot of fruit and vegetables.
I never count.
Do you think you might be?
I don't know whether I would eat as many as 10.
Don't be silly. I eat a reasonable amount. 10 portions is out of this world. It's stupid.
You're not even going to give it a go?
No.
Hi, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio. We're asking people if they've heard this idea of eating 10 portions of fruit and vegetables a day and whether they're managing.
Oh, probably yes. I think it was on the radio. I haven't changed my eating habits, which are good.
So do you think you might actually be achieving it some days?
It depends on your portion size, doesn't it? I'm not scientific enough to be weighing everything. But don't smoke, don't drink, live very moderately, eat small portions,
right.
Maintain weight.
Right. So I'll see you here in 50 years then.
I hope not. I hope there'll be voluntary euthanasia by then. Seriously, MP should vote for it. There we are.
There you go.
Thank you.
Bye, man. Thank you.
I wouldn't think I eat 10. I do eat a lot of fruit, a lot of fruit. But 10 is pushing it, I feel. Yes, pushing it. Even if you're really thinking about it, that's quite hard to do. And also, for some people, cost-wise, unless they're, you know, you've got to eat the fruits that are in season and get them. If you grow your own, of course, cheaper. And I do some of that in the summer, but that's summer, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
What happens in the winter? I like to freeze some, yeah, that helps. No, real tough ask, that one.
Well, I eat a lot, don't you ask him?
Yeah, you do eat a lot.
I do, yes.
Do you think you manage 10?
Perhaps not quite, but I do eat a lot. It's just got strawberries, and then I have apples and pears and bananas.
And vegetables.
Yeah, broccoli, sprouts,
yes.
Carrots.
Oh,
I eat a lot.
Yeah.
Because I love them, really.
That was the people of Cambridge's views on eating 10 portions of fruit and vegetables a day. It's not official advice, though, is it, Alan?
No, it isn't. It's a big piece of research, but official advice is still to eat 5 a day. So how many do you get through?
Well, only because I have a blender on me will I sometimes get through 5 a day of fruit and maybe spinach blended in as well, because it doesn't have any flavour that goes along with it. But honestly, no. God, at 5 I struggle regularly.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
For me, a real joy in food is finding small, out-of-the-way providers who far surpass anything you'd buy in most shops. It's almost a hidden world, known only by a few fellow searchers. And somebody who definitely fits into that category is this baker, whose bread Hans Schweitzer praised so highly earlier.
I'm Alison McTaggart. I run Bread on a Bike, and I make naturally leavened, slow, long fermentation breads, mostly, in Cambridge.
And you used to deliver to customers by bike. Do you still do that?
I did. I reached a point where the demand was so great for the bread that I had, you know, I couldn't do everything. I couldn't bake and deliver everything. I was, you know, spending 2 to 3 hours a day on the bike, which was great, and I loved doing that, but it wasn't sustainable. So at some point, I think it was 2015, I made a decision to kind of review, you know, the business and think about what the future would be. So I decided to start looking for premises, stop my deliveries, reduced my baking days to give myself that, you know, that space. And actually I'm still in that situation, still, you know, working out what the future will be, and baking a couple of days a week, Thursdays and Fridays, but still in big demand. I make as much as I can.
So how many loaves would you make in a typical week, do you think?
On my main baking days for sort of individual customers, I can make up to 90 loaves a day. I'm still using my domestic oven, and the space I have available is my limit on a daily basis. I make bagels as well. I make other sort of bread for other places, so other commercial customers. So I suppose it must be over 200 a week.
Right. And what sorts of bread do you make? I mean, you've mentioned bagels, but sort of more conventional loaves. What?
I mean, my main method is sourdough. So I'm making a range of white breads, wholemeal breads. Always make 100% rye loaf, and then a special. So on a weekly basis, I'm offering each of those, and I've got a number of different options. I think I've got quite a wide range of options, really, but 40, 50 different breads.
How can there be 40 or 50 different breads?
Well, different variations on recipes. So, I mean, the whole meal, which I guess are the ones that are my favourites, you can have a plain 100% wholemeal. You can have something that's got sunflower seeds in it. That's something that a bread that has sesame in it, linseed, a mixture of seeds, using different leavens to give it. I suppose my inspiration is probably German, Scandinavian, Eastern European breads. I'm always looking at breads, recipes, what other people are doing. You know, those are a constant source of inspiration, and you're constantly looking for recipes in different options.
So right, well, that's interesting.
Constant development.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to ask you, given the number of loaves you've made and the different types of bread you've made,
yeah,
are you still developing? It sounds like you are.
It's a constant state of development, and I think that's what makes bread making for me. I don't know, it's something that feeds me. I find it really fascinating. You know, there's the craft, the actual making of the bread, and I guess for a baker, making the perfect loaf, which, considering the number of variables there are that can affect sourdough, is constantly a challenge and a development. You're always seeking better and better. There's also, I suppose, an exciting move in this country towards more local, sustainable breads and flours. Modern wheat has been bred for higher yields and to make production of it easier. The cost of that has been that we've lost varieties and flavour that comes from the ancient grains. John Cook from Swaffham Mill, who uses corn from Wimpole Hall, the Wimpole estate. Howard Roberts is the farmer there. So we, you know, it's not me working directly with them, but, you know, we've been part of a whole interest in this area of having a good supply of local wheat, of some older varieties.
The method of baking bread that you use, or the sourdough method, people seem to be quite wary of it in the sense that they think it's a difficult thing to do. Should they get started? And if they should, how do they get started? Because there's quite a lot of different and sometimes conflicting advice as well.
I think, yes, definitely get started. I think when I started with a sourdough, I did a sourdough course in 2011, which was, you know, what started me off on all this, really. And it completely hooked me. And I think in the beginning, I thought I knew quite a lot. I mean, looking back now, there was so much I didn't know, but I was still making decent bread. I think as somebody at home who just wants to produce bread for them or is interested in the whole thing, yes, of course, do it. You know, make your own bread. You'll be so pleased and excited that you've made it. The taste will be amazing. You know, it may not look amazing the first time, but the second time you make it, it'll be better. You'll learn. I think it can be confusing because, you know, you look at different books and they seem to say different things. So I would choose one method, find a book, you follow that method, make it, see what the results are, then try it again, and, you know, stick with that for a while and see how it goes. You'll learn from actually doing it, and then maybe if you want to expand to other methods or read other people's ideas, then fine. But I think stick with one to start with and just get going, just get making bread.
Any particular book, or doesn't it matter as long as you stick to it?
I mean, people really like Chad Robertson, which is the tartine, but he makes a very wet dough, which with British flours is a challenge. So, you know, you bear that in mind if you follow tartine, because it's a very wet dough, which is a difficult one to start with. I think Josie Baker, I think he has a book which presents bread making in a very simple, stepwise way. I think that's quite good. I also think Richard Bertinet, who's done a couple of books, Dough and Crust, you know, which are more French-type breads, really, but I think his methods are good as well. So I guess, you know, have any one of those as your starting point. And go from there. Just make it.
Right. Okay. Where can people buy your bread from?
I make bagels for Urban Larder, my local cafe, and that's part of their menu. So people, you know, people would have them as part of a dish. I also supply Cotto, who've recently moved to the Gonville Hotel. So they've come back to me for some of their breads, which is really lovely, really great. Because of the scale I'm working on, I'm certainly not pushing, you know, the commercial side of things, because I just don't have the capacity. I guess my exciting development this week is that I've actually taken a step to buy a semi-commercial oven. So I'm going to have to spend the next day sorting, well, this evening actually, you know, reorganising stuff in my kitchen so that I can manage to get this oven in as well. And that I'll see where that takes me. I think it may enable me to do some more, but I think it will enhance the quality of bread as well.
So how can an individual customer get in touch and enjoy your bread?
I bake to order, so I have a mailing list, so if people contact me through my email account or, you know, I'm on all the social media, so they
can... So we can find you on Facebook, for example?
Yeah, Facebook, Instagram...
Twitter,
all those.
Right, just look up Bread on a Bike.
At Bread on a Bike.
And make contact with you and...
Yes, that's right. Then I would put them onto the mailing list. They would receive an email. At the moment, that happens on a Monday, and that tells you the breads that are available to order for that week.
Right.
And then they just let me know what they want and when, and it happened. We make it happen. And there's my oven.
There's some bread happening.
Excuse me.
And that was Alison McTaggart, Bread on a Bike, who bakes in her house in Romsey Town. And Alison will be at the Farmers Market in the Museum of Technology on Easter Saturday selling her bread, so go and get some.
Mm.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Now, last time, I spoke with Stella Pereira about her preparations for her supper club gathering. They included making her own knives from wood, making copper bowls, making spoons, dining table napkins, and so on. It was many, many solid hours of work. But you went along to it, Alan, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I was absolutely delighted to be there. And it's another example of what I was saying earlier about finding people who make food of a quality far and away better than anything you'd get in most commercial premises. The skill and effort Stella put into the preparations you spoke with her about were easily equaled by the food she made. It was superb. I asked her about what she made with a few sound bites from the evening in the background.
The salt cod, it's on the menu, it's just down a salt cod. So there's the bacalhau au braj, which is sort of like the hash that was in the middle of the plate.
This is nice.
And then there's the salt cod with the crust, the crumbs, with the broas, which is cornbread. So two dishes. And then there's the pastel de bacalhau, which is a shredded cod and potatoes and parsley again. But it's just a different texture. It's a little sort of like croquette, slightly stringy, and it's the way you treat the salt cod. So you pull it until it's become quite stringy. And then the other one was the, again, salt cod and potatoes, but it's cod and cream. So in Portuguese it's bacalhau com natas, and I made that into a little croquette as well. So this dish just shows you what you can do with salt cod, because even though you've only got like two or three basic ingredients, salt cod, potatoes, and parsley, and then there's the onion and the garlic, because cod needs garlic, you can achieve completely different textures and flavours depending on how you treat the cod itself.
So that one plate contained four different dishes?
Technically, yeah. four different dishes in one.
That was amazing.
And when we came in, we started with prosciutto, didn't we, on bread?
Yes, that's
a breadstick.
That's from Lamego, which is up in Trás dos Montes, and my attempt of olive oil bread, which still needs to be worked on. But I wanted that sort of like crusty, really light bread with a bit of presunto from Lamego, which is the traditional Portuguese presunto. And then the prawn risoles, which are my favorite little things. They're basically like a prawn bisque stuffed into a crispy choux pastry. And I always use sourdough because it kind of, as a crumb, because it kind of adds another dimension to the flavor of it. And actually, one of the things that I put in my prawn risoles is aguardiente. I'm not sure if anyone else does it, but I think it livens it up a bit. Aguardiente is fire water. So that's sort of, I don't know, I just like to do it.
And the sourdough you make yourself?
No, I get it from Adelia. So I actually request a few days before I'm actually going to do it, because you need to age it so you can get a really good dry crumb to make breadcrumbs, which are usually very lightly toasted, because then during the frying process you toast it a bit more, so it has to be very light and very, very fine, actually.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Adelia is Norfolk Street,
yes,
bakery. Yeah. And then there was a dish with pork as well.
Yes, that's basically a cozida portuguesa, which is a very heavy winter dish. And usually when I told some of the people that I was going to make cozida portuguesa, they thought, how are you going to do that? Because, you know, people, when you think of a cozida, you think of a massive plate of food and you literally can't move afterwards. But it's the flavor that I like. The main part of that dish for me was the cozida sauce. It's the broth where you cook everything and you start with the salted meats. And then you use the sausages, so the chorizo, the moro, the blood sausages, and then with the same broth you start to cook other things in it. So the chicken or the market veg, it was all cooked in the same broth. And I actually then thickened the sauce with the potatoes themselves. So yeah, everything sort of tastes smoky.
And that's why it was so good, really. It's quite a complex dish.
It is. It takes absolute ages to prepare. You start in the morning and it's all slow cooked, and you just extract all the flavors from all the meats, the different, you know, the bones and the broths. The broth becomes very rich. You know, potatoes that taste smoky and with all the depth of flavor, it's amazing. I think it's really, really good.
And then we had ice cream.
Ah, yes. So there's hazelnut, chocolate, churros, orange, cherries, what else? What have I missed? Rhubarb, roast rhubarb in port.
Is that
the ice cream? Mm. The ice cream was rhubarb, forced rhubarb, and that was macerated in port and orange peel, and then slow roasted, then churned into an ice cream. I also did a port reduction, which I added during the churning process.
And then, I mean, there were so many things in this meal. There was the
ginginha. The ginginha is it's sour cherry liqueur. It usually comes from Óbidos, and you could have it in, you know, a normal cup, or you could have it in a chocolate cup. So I made a dark chocolate cup that was shaped sort of like a frayed peony, or puny, a frayed peony.
Peony, yeah.
And served it in that. And there was also, you could either have it on its own with the chocolate cup, or there was a little sour cherry hanging on the top of a brunch. So you would say you can have ginginha com elas or sem elas, with them or without them, with the sour cherry or without the sour cherry.
But there was other chocolate as well, wasn't there?
Yes, there was the brunch.
The chocolate brunch.
And that's sort of like my... The whole dessert was... Everything that was on it represented something about spring. So there was an egg nest, which is the egg strings, and that's a very traditional Portuguese thing to do. And you basically make very, very fine strings of egg yolk in sugar syrup, and it just looks like angel hair. And it's quite sweet, but, you know, and I tried not to make it very overpowering. So there was that element. the nest. There was the swirl, the churro swirl, which is a snail crawling up, you know, the brunch. The brunch was a dark chocolate brunch with freeze-dried cherries dusted on the meringues, and the meringues were the actual flowers. It was all served on a board, a wooden board made out of local hazelnut wood, and that was Carlos's element, my husband. The pudding, the chocolate pudding, was a puddle of chocolate and hazelnut liqueur. So, you know, it kind of takes you through the seasons where cherry blossom, even though you don't get cherries now, I try to use an element. The xinxinha, for example, is preserved cherries. So I'd use the element that I want, how you would find it in this season. So cherries were in the form of preserved cherries or freeze-dried cherries. So this is what it's really about. It's kind of like connecting the seasons and using things as seasonally as possible.
And it was very well received. The atmosphere was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the thing that I enjoy most about these suppers is, to me, it's not just the food. The food is just an element that gets people talking. To me, it's actually the people that sit around the table, and I keep saying this, it's the people, because you can give them, you know, really, really good food, and if you don't have the right atmosphere, it's not going to be an enjoyable night. And sometimes if you have really simple food, you can achieve a magical evening just with the mood, the lighting, you know, everything on the table kind of brings that together. The music, the use of the community around us. Yeah, it's about bringing people together at the table. People that don't know each other, some know each other, but they'll leave like they've known each other for all their lives. I think you kind of got that feeling at the end of it.
Yeah, well, it was a great night. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Stella Pereira. If you're interested in being on Stella's mailing list for her supper clubs, email her, amesa@stellapereira.com. And if you want to read about last Saturday's supper club, Pina Broccoli Anaya's blog 1-2 Culinary Stew has an excellent piece about it, along with some photos.
So it was good then?
It was really good.
Listen to Cambridge 105 on Radio Player at cambridge105.fm. There's also free apps available for Google, Apple, Kindle Fire and Windows devices, making listening on the go through your smartphone or tablet easy. Stream powered by LoHo for all your internet service and telephony needs.
Now, partly inspired by Stella's Supper Club theme, which was a blossoming spring, and that spring began just the other week, I took a trip out to some city allotments to record the sounds, the thoughts of the locals, and because it was just so nice to finally be outside without needing a jacket.
The start of the growing season, isn't it, really? It's the time when you start digging, preparing the soil, start planting out your seedlings and things.
When the equinox came, I was desperate because I hadn't put in my parsnips, and I'm putting them in today.
Parsnips must be grown at the beginning of spring?
Yes, the ground must be the right temperature.
Ah.
And I forgot my thermometer, but I put them in anyway. You learn, you know.
Yeah.
You just get feel for it. And it's different in every part of the country. So if you come from Wales, you'll find this is so calcareous here. Dry. And that is a problem.
Well, a lot of it's been about being outside as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
You spend all winter indoors when it's dark and everything. When it comes to this kind of weather, you can feel, you know, as though your world has enlarged a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like having a garden in a way, you know, you can sit out there and after you've done your work, have a glass of wine or something, you know, it's actually quite pleasant, although a lot of it's hard work, and I think we're doing the hard work today.
Yeah.
In preparation for the sort of rewards later on down the line.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, putting in the work for rewards later, I think.
You've been in Cambridge a long time?
Since 59, quite a long time. So our first allotment in the 60s,
when the children were young. But when the second child came, eat all worms and soil, and so we gave it up. It was difficult. And there wasn't any water down here. And I used to come down with the pram with bottles of water, where you can water things.
So everybody has a steady supply?
Everybody can have water, yes. Mm. It made a lot of difference.
But it can be quite solitary. So that's, I think, is the great thing about allotment. You're doing something, it's a communal thing, but at the same time, you're by yourself.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing. It's a nice feeling that you're with people.
Those are artichokes.
Oh, they are artichokes.
Yes. Oh. Well, I've got rhubarb up there. Do you want to look at it?
Oh, yeah.
And recognise it?
Yeah.
This is rhubarb here. Would you like some?
That would be great, yeah. Yeah.
How many people would you be feeding?
Two.
Two?
Two.
Okay. That's probably enough. So now what you need to do is you cut it up and bring it to the boil and then immediately throw away the water and then put a little more water in and cook it for about 5 minutes.
What's the significance of getting rid of the boiling water and then...
So much acid.
And then cook it up in cold water brought to the boil for 5 minutes.
Yes, I think throw away the water immediately, put a little more water in, sugar, and cook it. 5 minutes.
Something. Lovely.
Yes.
And yourself, sir?
Yeah.
No, it's my partner.
Fiona's the main allotment person. I just come along when there's hard work to be done.
The heavy work,
like,
yes.
Shifting all that soil at the back there and putting it in bags and taking it to the dump. But yeah, she's the creative side of the partnership.
Have you had this allotment for very long?
Yes, quite a long time. And my son got it first, and then I asked if I could have a little bit. Years ago, I had an allotment, but gave it up for various reasons. Too much to do, really.
Mm.
Now, I've got time.
It doesn't look much at the moment, but, you know...
The great thing I like about it is that it's got a lovely plum tree there and an apple tree there. And, like, you don't have to do anything to them. They're there, and they have loads of plums on it come September.
Yeah,
and, like, you don't have to do anything. You know, it's just there, and it's yours. You know, that's what I like about it. You don't have to dig anything. You don't have to prune anything. You know, it just every year, it just keeps on giving us vast amounts of plums. It's just fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
I share my allotment with my son, you see. I have just that little plot there. And that's enough for me.
These are purple sprouting broccoli, yes?
Yes, they are. I need to pick them today and have them for supper. Oh, I've got some white, look.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And look at that butterfly, peacock. You see the rhubarb?
Yeah.
Come right, 2 feet. Come round this
way. I'm blind.
If we get the shadow on him, he'll fly very, very slowly.
Oh, I see him now.
Isn't he beautiful?
Yes. He's quite small, isn't he? There he goes.
There he goes. That's what spring means to me, really, when the butterflies come. Oh, two of them.
Two of them.
I don't know where his mate's gone.
Just popped down the shops, I think.
Possibly.
So you're looking forward to many months being out in the sun?
Yes, yeah, it's great. I mean, we've got a south-facing plot. It's great.
I'm very envious of all of these allotments.
Well, one day you'll have an allotment when you're a grandpa. Won't you?
That was a few Cambridge people talking about their allotments in the spring. That rhubarb made a really lovely syrup too. I didn't make crumble, but it does go well with fish dishes and gammon.
Oh, well, we don't talk about rhubarb enough, I don't think.
No.
In today's Guardian magazine, Ottolenghi has a recipe, black spaghetti with pickled rhubarb, ginger and peanuts.
Mm.
So if you'd saved some rhubarb, Matt, you could have made that. And on to the food and drink news for Cambridge now, beginning with jobs, and some very interesting ones too, like how would you like to work full-time at Jack's Gelato? It includes kitchen work as well as being out there scooping. Say why you think you're suitable and send a CV. Details are on the Jack's Gelato Facebook page.
Zio Mario, the new artisan bakery near the station, is looking urgently for a temporary baker. So you can go in and talk with them about it. To find Zio Mario, as you leave the station building, just turn left. It's about 100 metres along the road.
The Red Lion in Grantchester is looking for a commis chef, full-time or part-time, and a chef de partie. Send your CV to the head chef or phone 07817 283 182.
Pint Shop in Pease Hill is looking for chefs, bartenders and servers. So if that sounds like you, do get in touch with Nikki, N-I-C-K-I-E, at pintshop.co.uk.
Tonight, Food Park opens a new pitch. It's by the Mill Pond at the University Centre Wine Bar. That's in Granter Place at the bottom of Mill Lane. It's in collaboration with Cambridge Wine Merchants. The lineup is Gorilla Kitchen and Holy Schnitzels, serving from 5pm, and there will be DJs and comedy going in the bar. Eat in or take away.
Now, we talked a bit today about small producers, almost hidden, in fact, in Cambridge. Well, the Sunday market is a great place to find some of them. One we've mentioned several times before is Hawthorne Farm. They used to sell out by lunchtime, but now, such is their popularity that they've often sold all their meat by 9:30. They've tried to up production slightly, and tomorrow they should have pork and venison, as well as chicken and eggs. It's where street food traders Holy Schnitzels get their venison from, by the way.
An event on the 8th of April, a Persian feast run by Food Cycle. Tickets are available on the Eventbrite website.
A bit more street food now. This Wednesday, Steak and Honour will be parked up outside the Queen's Head in Newton, whilst the Wandering Yak will be there on the 12th of April. Both will be serving from 6 until 8:30pm-ish.
Some courses coming up at Cambridge Cookery School in Purbeck Road off Hills Road. The 11th of April, Easter chocolate making for children with Mama Bonbon. That's from 10 till 12, and it's repeated on the 12th of April.
There's a course on Easter chocolates for adults too, so no need to feel left out. That's on the 12th of April, 6 to 9pm. A course for teens on 15-minute family meals is also on the 12th. That's from 1:30 to 4pm. And another course for teens, 13th of April, hot cross buns and other Easter breads. Lots more too. All of these can be found on the Cambridge Cookery School website.
There's a farmer's market at the Cambridge Museum of Technology on Easter Sunday.
And finally, on the 21st of April, CAM Events have Italian wines pop-up with Inda's Kitchen. It's at Co 15 in Cherry Hinton, and tickets are available from the Eventbrite website.
And that's all we have time for today. If you miss bits or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, there's a repeat at 7am tomorrow, and there's a podcast from early next week.
And remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter, @flavour105. You can also follow Cambridge 105 Radio itself, @Cambridge105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio this afternoon, Cambridge Minds with Trevor Dan, an excellent programme. 1:30 till 2, the science show, and from 2 till 3, 21st century women. But that's all from us. We'll be back on the 15th of April. And until then,
goodbye.